Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and we are going to spend this next part of our program looking at what happened in Italy and Austria in these two elections and why they so profoundly affect where we are now. I think, and they say a lot about where our country is now. We're joined by David Broder, who is a translator and member of the Historical Materialism Editorial Board, who lives in Rome, where he's working on his PhD on dissident communists in the Italian Renaissance. And David, good to have you with us.
Oh, hi. You right?
And Benjamin Apratko is with us. He is a lecturer in political science at the University of Vienna, a writer, editor of Mosaic Blog, an online platform for critical commentary and political analysis in Austria. And Benjamin, welcome. Good to have you with us as well. Oh, he's not there yet? Okay, he'll be there in a minute. Okay, so we'll come back to him shortly. So, and Dr. Max Hilaire, I guess, is coming in the studio shortly. But you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. By email, you can tweet us at Mark Steiner. And we get to look forward to your thoughts. So let me just start, David. I mean, what happened in Italy, some people look at that, you know, look at that, the news here in America and watch what's going on and wonder why is this important. But this is really you can describe this vote and what it really means from Italy. But I have some very specific questions, because in many ways, the people who supported this vote that ousted, in some ways, forced the prime minister to resign in Italy, reflects the divide here in America in some ways I want to get into. But talk a bit about what happened there, what this vote was about.
Okay. Well, for some years, there's been talk in Italy about reforming the electoral system. Indeed, an electoral system that was declared unconstitutional by the Constitutional Court. And earlier this year, Prime Minister Matteo Renzi put forward a proposal to change the constitution, which thus had to go to referendum. At the time that he started talking about this, he looked like he might win 60-70% yes votes for his changes. But the problem that he had is that since he announced the referendum, you've had these other big upheavals, of course, the Brexit vote and then the election of Donald Trump. And also that Matteo Renzi said that he'd resign if he lost on the constitutional reform. So even though the actual subject of the vote was a quite, in some ways, a quite arcane change, the election became personalized around Renzi and became more polarized as a kind of opposition between the government and all other kinds of opposition and revolt against the elite. So foreign media, of course, have particularly sought to portray this as part of the kind of domino effect, the rise of populism, possibly even a threat to the European Union. Renzi was a very pro-EU and pro-Euro prime minister, and the risk is that this will bring early elections in which Eurosceptic parties could come to power, and the Five Star Movement, a populist movement, and also right-wing parties like the Northern League are suggesting having a referendum on Italy's Euro membership, so that the third biggest Euro economy, and that would have a devastating effect on the Eurozone.
So I want to turn to Benjamin Apratko, who's joining us now from Vienna as well. Benjamin, welcome. Good to have you on the program with us.
Hi.
And because I said earlier, Benjamin Apratko is a lecturer in political science at the University of Vienna, writer, blogger at Mosaic Blog, an online platform of critical commentary and political analysis in Austria. And before I come back to Italy, because I want to talk about the poles there of the right and the left opposing this and coming together to against the European Union. And it's just the complexities of what's happening in Europe now and what they say about the kind of a reflection in some ways of the same kind of polarization in America. But there's also – Austria shows that with this completely divided nation, it seems, between this anti-immigration right-wing party that almost won but lost to a broader coalition of people who were left and liberal and run by a person who used to be the head of the Green Party. So what's that dynamic?
Well, it is, in a sense, of course, a dynamic of polarization, but I think it's also different than the one that David just described in Italy. So what you have in Austria is, first of all, an audible sigh of relief right now for many people in the country and
right.
and in other parts of Europe, where I think people were looking rather anxiously at this election and at the prospect of a hard right head of state being elected there. And of course, in the context of the Brexit vote, the election of Donald Trump, this was seen as a possible next step in this global trend towards nationalism, racism, authoritarian populism. This has been held back, and of course that's good news in many ways. But also there's been a price that the Green Party candidates had to pay for this, which was to assemble an almost impossible coalition ranging from conservatives, liberals, neoliberals, all to the left and the extra parliamentary left as well, which then in the end just got a little more than 50% of the vote. So that's still, I think, a larger problem that there's that we have to address here.
So it seems to be a mess. Maybe I'm making too much of this, but let me see what you both think. Kind of a mess, kind of confusion about where the world really wants to be in some ways. Mm. You know, you look at the vote that took place in Britain, the Brexit vote, and there were people on the left and the right who were for that vote. Yet many younger people and communities of color did not want to leave the European Union because they saw a different kind of future in the world. But then other people on the left saw it as a kind of a capitalist domineering European alliance that plunges people into poverty and austerity. And both those things, I think, in some ways are true. So, I mean, that's where I think – let me turn first to David Broder, then come right back to Benjamin Oprotko. I mean, I think that's where all the – I think it's why it's so confusing for people, because nobody really – to wander our way through that complexity, to understand what's really going on, you know what I'm saying, and what these votes – what do they really reflect?
Sure. I mean, I think in the Italian case is strange in the sense that this certainly wasn't a left-right divide. The constitution that Renzi sought to change has traditionally been associated with the left. It was an achievement of the Italian resistance in World War II, created in 1948. It has kind of very progressive values written into it. While the left opposed Renzi's reform on the basis that it was would allow his government to more quickly break up the post-war social contract, the right opposed it really to get him out of office. And as I said, the problem is that the specific national situation is overlaid by the kind of general European crisis. I mean, I think what's worth noting is while in the case of Trump or the Brexit vote or Le Pen in France, it's many kind of old or middle-aged white, particularly male voters. And you know, you said yourself in the Brexit vote, sort of young people and minorities were mainly for Remain. The strange thing about Italy is this is a very heavy youth vote against Renzi and for the no. 81% of under 35s have voted no.
Huh.
So I think in that sense it's problematic to see it in terms of a kind of rise of nationalism or an anti-migrant thing or a kind of a cultural reactionary thing. I think it's very much bound up with the specific problems of young people in Italy. Very high unemployment. Most Italian 30-year-olds live with their parents. And so it's the problem the European Union as an institution has is that all of these national crises are happening for different reasons and in different ways, yet all of them serve to add to the crisis of European stability and to impede its efforts at economic recovery. It's a very unwieldy institution with 28 states, and it's about to lose one of them. And I think it's there's no kind of collective management of the different crises in these different countries. So I find it hard to see how it's going to extricate itself from a dynamic of rising polarization.
Before we turn back to Benjamin Protko, let me introduce to our audience again, once again, Dr. Max Hilaire, who's joined us in studio. He's chairman of the political science department at Morgan State University. Max, good to see you.
Thank you, Mac, for inviting me.
Good to have you here.
Thanks. So, Mac,
since you jumped in, Max, do you want to comment on this kind of – we would kind of parse way through what all this means when you have the complexities of race and immigration and youth and aging populations and right and left really in a very kind of – in some ways state of turmoil. Whether it's here in the United States, or and I even look, we won't talk about this today. I can look at the election that took place in the Gambia. We should know about that another day, right? But I'm saying so, and we're looking at what happened in Austria and Italy, and your perspective, and then we'll go back to.
Well, if I can comment on Italy, I mean, number one, it was a vote against Renzi. Two, Italy lost 2 million jobs during the financial crisis beginning in 2008 and only recovered under Renzi 600,000 jobs created. Many of those are young people who have find it extremely difficult to survive independent of their parents. I think there's another problem to this Italian situation, which is Renzi looking to reduce the size of the Senate in Italy, which is extremely powerful, and then to centralize power within the federal government or the central government in Italy. As is now, power is highly decentralized, more so than in any EU country or in the United States. And the mayors and council members felt that was sort of taking away powers from them. I mean, certainly the bureaucracy in Italy, the federal bureaucracy is heavily bloated. But even when I was in Italy and about a year ago and talked to people about Renzi, who appeared to be a very charismatic, very young and up and rising, and the manner in which he came into office, he was never elected. So Italians had some resentment about the manner in which they felt it was a violation of the constitution initially for Renzi to come into office in a backdoor manner. And then he certainly did not have the mandate to look to reduce the size of the Senate. So this referendum was a mixture of many things and not just. Now, with Austria, if I could comment, it was really an anti-immigrant election because the right in Austria very much take the position that bringing in Muslim was diluting the Austrian culture and that they did not or cannot integrate fully into Austria. I'm not sure. I go to Vienna quite often. It's a beautiful place, and I am not sure anyone but an Austrian can integrate into Austrian society. So I may be wrong, but this is a country that you don't really make friends very easy, and it's not a place you feel as if I mean, it's a diplomatic city. There are lots of diplomats in Austria. But I as I said, I've been going to Austria since 1982 and sometimes twice a year, and it's a beautiful country. Vienna is very pretty. But you don't get the sense in Vienna, in particular, that people are very friendly and very hospitable as others. Even France and Czech Republic and others, you find a lot more welcoming.
So let me bring Benjamin Oplatko back, our guest from the University of Vienna.
I almost feel like I have to invite you over.
I would certainly welcome that because, as I said, I love Vienna. I love
only if I can. Only if I can carry the bags.
Might,
I'm sorry.
You finally might meet a few friendly people there as well. Then, maybe coming back to your first question, Mark. I think what can be seen both in Italy and in Austria, in the Austrian case. And also, in a sense, in the UK and the Brexit vote, is this confusion that emerges from, among other things, a failure of the left to articulate that opposition in a meaningful way. Mm-hmm. So what you have, especially in Austria, where there is no left party in parliament, the kind of linkage between racism, anti-migration, anti-refugee positions with a, at least superficially, anti-neoliberal rhetoric, plus the failure of the left to pick up on the ground and politically, allows the hard right to almost monopolize this position of opposition in the political space. And this is one of the most, I think, dangerous things that has happened in Austria, also during this election campaign right now.
So what is that? I mean, coming back to our other two guests here, but very quickly, what does that mean, though, Benjamin, and for this election? I mean, why did the hard right lose? Not by that much, but why did they lose?
I think there's two main reasons for that. One is Van der Bellen, the guy who eventually won, and his campaign managers very wisely, I think, chose to focus on specific sectors of society, mainly conservative rural voters. This, as I said, came with a price because it also meant that he had to pander to the right. He was, I think, very weak on topics like migration, refugees, border, but also on social issues. But he was keen not to alienate conservative voters. But in the end, it helped him to win the election. So from his perspective, I think it was the right choice, even though it meant that I think the campaign as a whole has shifted the whole political terrain more to the right than to the left, even though he won. The second aspect of this is that there was almost this kind of unofficial campaign that was not necessarily part of the official organized campaign of many young people, especially in the cities, who, you know, did all the groundwork there. They went out leafletting, they were knocking on doors, they organized cultural events. I know of people who organized a choir that went from district to district and city to city to sing. So all these things happened, and that helped, I think, a lot in bringing out voters who, you know, usually wouldn't vote for the right-wing guy anyways, but maybe wouldn't have bothered to vote in the cities, in the urban areas. And these are the two major voting blocks that Van der Bellen successfully mobilized, and in the end won by a pretty clear margin of 56 to 44%. No, I'm sorry, 54 to 46.
So one of the things that we, if you look at what just happened in Italy and Austria, and you also look at what happened in Britain earlier with Brexit, that... And I have not. I've seen that Marie Le Pen has kind of seen this as in France as saying, yes, we can win this French election because this is the move now in Europe, in this direction, to more nationalist kind of feeling into to the right, and part of that though I think is a complexity of the European Union itself, which is that people. Internationalism is something people have fought for a long time, to go beyond our kind of little borders and saying that we can be more than that. But at the same time, that has been defined by mostly, for want of a better term, international capital. It's been defined by the 1%. It's not been defined by anything else, which is unleashes contradictions that make people go, well, we don't want this then. They bring it all back home. And I think, Max, that's part of the problem, that people are trying to parse this through, and it's really lacks the clarity because we, I think, in some ways lack the analysis in a broader sense.
Well, I think the point is well taken. I think internationalism and globalization certainly brought tremendous wealth and benefit to that 1% and also small group of middle-class people in the various countries. It certainly lifted a lot of people in Brazil, India, China out of poverty. But I think we've left behind a very significant percentage of the world's population. And hence, what we see in Europe, particularly in the European Union, it's a victim of its own success, that Europe, as a community of 28 countries, 500 million people, has done well in integrating Central and Eastern Europe very peacefully into the European Union, into Western institutions. They have really thrive as a result, and hence you see this backlash. The same Eastern and Central European countries who were looking to the EU, looking to Western institutions for liberation and economic development, are now turning against that success. And part of Europe's problem, and also in the United States, not ignore that, is the fact that we see the quality of leadership in many of these countries, whether it's in Europe, in the United States, and elsewhere, has declined. So we're looking at multiple global problems that can only be solved collectively through multilateral institutions. But many countries, whether the United States or Britain or even the right in France, are looking for a local solution for their problems and not seeing the interconnectedness of whether it's the impact of climate change on the North African countries, the war in Syria, which certainly did not start with the brutal authoritarian rule of Assad, but one should take it back all the way to the Sykes-Picot Agreement 100 years ago. So we simply cannot ignore the interconnectedness of many of these problems and shying away from them. It's only multiplying the problem or magnifying it. And we somehow have to deal with it at some point, but it can't be swept under the rug.
So David Broder, please jump in. Could you pick up on that from your perspective in Italy?
Well, I mean, I think it's one of the interesting aspects of the Italian situation is really the divide between the hundreds of thousands of Italian young people who've moved abroad in search of work, and then those who are left behind. I mean, obviously, the European Union is excellent for those who want to or are able to. Travel and find work in other countries. But in a way, it also has the problem that it forces them to do so because the Italian economy is unable to revive from its two decades of stagnation, partly because it's not able to devalue its currency anymore. So the problem is that although the idea of international cooperation for these problems, things like climate change, for third world development and so on, the idea of international cooperation is good. But the problem is that effectively Italy is locked into a situation where the government has no real freedom of action. In a way, it's a kind of slow motion version of what happened in Greece, in the sense that now that Italy is in the euro, it would be absolutely disastrous for it to leave. And yet at the same time, it's gradually effectively having wages and conditions brought down to the same level as they are in Central Eastern Europe. But more broadly, I think, while after the Second World War, the European project was very attractive to countries like Italy and also other Southern European countries that had dictatorships, and the idea of being European was a way of being a modern democratic country, of ensuring peace among the countries of Europe. Firstly, the last war is now so long ago that even the idea of conflict doesn't really weigh on people's minds and young people's minds as a kind of concern of theirs as compared to old people who lived through the last war. But also, I mean, you know, the European Union was set up during the Cold War when Europe was sandwiched between the United States and then the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc. So while in that period, Europe had a kind of common mission, and that extended in the post-1989 period with the incorporation of the Central Eastern European countries. It no longer had any kind of optimistic vision to offer. Really, what it had left is the idea that all of the alternatives are worse, or that its collapse would have disastrous effects. And I think it's connected to the question of poor political leadership, in the sense that the EU has no vision to project; it has nothing to offer its citizens. So when people feel left behind, abandoned, that they don't have economic prospects, it's only natural that they're going to turn against that European ideas.
So we have 3 minutes left here.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I mean, people do irrational things in times of crises, and what we see in Italy or Britain is a decision that was made in a very simplistic manner, not taking into account the complexity of the issues. So let's take, for example, Italy, and Broder just mentioned, if Italy was out of the euro or the eurozone, it could devalue its currency as a way of generating exports and reducing the import. But Italy's currency would still be pegged to the euro, and the European Central Bank would have to make decisions. All transactions in international trade would have to be done in euros. Italy's debt would have to be paid in euros. So it makes it more costly. So I'm not sure if getting out of the European Union is an option for Britain, which they are now realizing, and then for Italy or anyone else. I think...
Well.
Go ahead.
No, I mean, I agree. I mean, I think the problem is that individual states generally have less power to resist the general flows of the world economy, of finance, of globalization. But that in voters' minds, the idea of reasserting national sovereignty is a quick fix to that problem. But it's a bit like kind of the idea of kind of Britain will have more freedom of action outside the EU. It's a bit like the idea that if you're on a ferry and you're not in control, and then you jump out and swim, well, you know, you have more independent control of direction you go, but you're also, you know, all at sea. So I would agree with your point that it wouldn't actually bring more sovereignty, but it is a politically appealing idea.
So I wish we did have more time for this. This has been a really fascinating discussion, and I hope I can gather the three of you again to have much longer discussion about all this and where we're going. Because I think this has been because it's for our listeners here in the States to really understand the effect of the complexity of European politics or politics in West Africa or other places, how they affect where the entire world's going is very critical. So we will invite you all back to have a much longer conversation. I really enjoyed this. David Broder, thank you so much. Looking forward to your piece on dissident communists and Italian resistance. I am. and Benjamin Oprotko, thank you so much for taking your time with us here all the way over in Vienna. I do deeply appreciate you being part of this conversation as well. And Dr. Max Hilaire, always great to have you in the studio. Chair of our department here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And
Benjamin and David.
Hey, Benjamin, I assume you're at the University of Vienna?
I am at the moment.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, I'll look you up when I come in February.
Yes. I'm looking forward to it.
We'll have some Viennese coffee or tea.
We'll have a coffee.
Okay, very good.
I'll connect you both by email.
Okay, very good.
We'll take a short break, and when we come back, we have to go local here in Baltimore City. The mayor is about to be inaugurated. We'll go to that inauguration and have commentary as well. Don't go away.